Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo, and I think we've got such an interesting topic today. I don't know about you, but I've always had a passion for horses, and thoroughbreds are one of a kind. They are absolutely awesome, and today we're going to be traveling to Kentucky. Yes, we're going to be talking about the greatest Kentucky Derby upsets. And this is a publication that was put out by the staff of Blood Horse Publications. And I want to welcome Ed Bowen as my guest. This man is very knowledgeable about horses. Ed, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here. Appreciate it.
It is a delight. Ed, give us a little bit of background about how you developed such a passion for these magnificent animals and the Kentucky Derby.
Well, I was lucky. I grew up in Florida. My father liked horses. We had riding horses. He had no particular interest in racing, but in those days you could watch the televised races from Hialeah, and I had an aunt who would send us the new Black Stallion book every year for Christmas, and those books had quite a bit about racing, and I just had the great blessing at the age of 10 to fall in love with something that I've never had to grow up and say, this isn't going to support you. So that's how I got into it, and then I got involved with the journalistic side, and now I'm work for a foundation that raises money for veterinary research, specifically for horses.
Now, the Kentucky Derby, correct me if I'm wrong, but was it established in 1904?
Now, the first Derby was in 1875.
1875?
Yes, ma'am, and it went through various phases. It got a lot of national publicity in the 1880s, then it sort of faded to a regional event, and then in 1915, when the best filly from the East won it, and the owner of the great stables in New York said, she's won the greatest race of all, that sort of cemented the Derby as a national event, and it's been seen as such ever since then.
That's 133 years of racing.
Right.
That is incredible, and it is so loved by millions. Now, give us a little bit of history about how this developed, and why was Kentucky chosen?
Well, there's a lot of factors went into it. As you know, the thoroughbred was well-established in England. This country was settled largely by English colonists, and far afield from their homeland, the people over here worked hard to duplicate the institutions they had at home. And through the South especially, and also in the North, there grew up this imitation of what they had come to know back home. And Kentucky and Tennessee emerged as great breeding centers. And then during the Civil War, because of its location, Kentucky had less devastation than the more southerly states, and so Kentucky kind of emerged out of the Civil War as the key breeding state, and then racing in some of the states as a reaction to religious feelings, racing passed out of some of the southern states, and Kentucky sort of had a lot of things go for it that helped it emerge as the leading state, including the great soil, the great climate, and so forth.
There is information in your book about a gentleman by the name of Peter Chew.
Yes.
And he made a statement about Joe Estes, and that Joe Estes divided Derby history into three general periods, 1875 to 1898, 1899 to 1914, and 1915 onward.
Right, right.
Now, tell us about each one of those periods. What made that breakdown so significant?
Well, the 1875, of course, was the founding of the race, and through 1898, the event had some emerging status, not only regionally but nationally. But then along in the 1890s, there was an incident where some of the eastern stables were displeased by the fact that the betting arrangements at Kentucky weren't up to the standards that they were expected, and so they quit shipping their horses from the east. And then the Derby went into a tailspin, and it was in 1915, as I said, when Regret won it. Now in the interim there, 1902 was a very key moment because a wonderful fellow named Matt Wynn, who was a tailor in Louisville and had seen every running of the Derby, he was convinced by the owners of Churchill Downs to come on board and try to manage the track. He left his tailoring business, took over the track just out of a respect for this institution in his own city that he had known. And so even though 1915 was, Mr. Estes is correct in calling that a bellwether event, Colonel Wynn had been gradually making some inroads. 1913 was a big event because the winner was a 90-1 shot that paid more than any other horse had, and that gave it some national publicity. 1914, a very popular horse named Old Rosebud won it, and then in 1915, when Mr. Whitney's Regret won the race, that's what really cemented it as a national event. And Colonel Wynn, bless his heart, was a P.T. Barnum of all time. He could take that advantage. He made it. He was a PR man. He began to seduce the New York media to come down and cover the race, and the event was off and running.
Now, women were involved in racing, too, which was so fascinating to me. You have a Mrs. Durnell that you talked about.
Yes.
In the book, and at that time, you wouldn't expect women to have been involved, even if they had had a passion for the animals, because it just wasn't to be done by women.
Well, it's a fascinating thing about the way racing evolved in this country. In the colonial and the post-colonial eras, when South Carolina, Charleston, and Annapolis, Maryland, when they were among the great centers of racing, it seems counterintuitive, I realize, but it became very socially prominent. Like when there would be a race meeting in Charleston, all the ladies would turn out in their finery. And so there was this kind of acceptance that ladies could be part of the scene many years before it became accepted that they might be participants. The Mrs. Bert Durnell you're talking about was the first person to win the Kentucky Derby with a horse racing in the name of her ownership. So
yeah.
There was a kind of a charming acceptance of ladies many years before that, and yet there was that barrier against their participation.
Yes, now, you have a story in here that reminded me so much of the movie Hidalgo, I believe it is, the racehorse, and it was, I think that's the name of it, but it was supposed to be a totally fraudulent story. But you talk about Mr. Donnell going to Europe and how he and Duggan made their way to Manchuria, where they attended a race meet, bought a horse, saddled a winner, and won a bet. I mean,
right.
Your stories
right.
in here, you could make a movie about every single one of the horses and all of the characters. They're wonderful.
Well, you know, the great thing about that era is he could come back from his adventures and make these claims, and there was no CNN or anybody to go over and see if it were really true. So I hope I made it clear in that chapter that these were stories that he came back telling. Now there are many proven examples of similar things. I'm not sure that Mr. Durnell did everything he claimed, but he really did have a colorful career, and that there were a number of people who came to this country after the Russian Revolution and established themselves in racing, for instance. But yeah, Bruce Durnell was a great character. You're right. That could make a movie.
That would make a fabulous, fabulous movie. Let's talk about one of your chapters. You title it The Longest Odds, and that's about Donerail, I believe.
Right.
And you have to think of money in the time frame, which I believe was 1913.
Right. That's
and
correct.
So he ended up paying $184.90 on a $2 bet. Now, what would that equate to in today's dollars?
Well, the first thing is the $2 bet would be, that sounds like the you know, anyone could come up with $2, but in those days that was a bit of a, you know, if you were a guy, just an ordinary guy going to the races, and to bet $2 would probably be comparable to be betting 20 or 40 today. And I would think that a $184 payoff would be comparable to, well over hitting $1,000 today. It would be comparable if a 500 to 1 shot won the Derby. That's kind of what you're looking at in terms of the stunning aspect of it from a sporting idea.
Now, you have in this story that you write about the race, and all of this is factual, you have a jockey, Roscoe Goose.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about how he started riding in his teens, and he ended up becoming one of the leading riders at the track, and he liked Donerail. What was so unique about Donerail? Why wouldn't he run well for anybody else, and what was the special relationship between him and this horse?
Well, horses are very sensitive. You know, you think about this huge animal, and yet you control him by a bit in his mouth, and his mouth is very sensitive, and it's very likely that this is conjecture. I don't know. I got to meet Roscoe Goose when he was an elderly gentleman, but just in conjecture, he probably had a style that he was just a little more gentle with the horse. If you get on a horse, whether it's a racehorse or any other kind of horse, and you sort of jerk him around by his mouth, and you know that's, and you forget that this is a very sensitive mouth, even though the animal's huge. So I suspect that Roscoe Goose just had a kind of a way of letting the horse do what he wanted to do, and the horse didn't get sour or resent what was being done in the saddle. So that can happen with a. There's so many things that go into whether you're a good racehorse or not. Just imagine if you're a young horse and the first person on your back is not very attuned to the fact that you've got this bit in your mouth and you need to have gentle care and so forth. But that's my guess, is that he just had a more sensitive touch with the horse between the reins and the bit.
You bring that race to life in a wonderful, wonderful way. You talk about how when the race started, it wasn't anything like the horse races you see today. What was so different in 1913 when the horses were being lined up?
Well, I want to make sure that I don't want to take credit or doesn't deserve. I wrote one of the chapters of this book. Many people wrote it. Evelyn Hunter wrote that particular chapter, and it was very compelling the way she described it there. And starting in about the late 1930s, we had starting gates that were more or less like they are today, a big contraption, individual stalls, a gate in front that opens. In those days, before that, there were various evolutional steps about how races were start. In this case, you just had horses, you had a starter there on a stand giving instructions. The idea, of course, was to have all the horses lined up evenly, standing still, and then he would give the signal and off they'd go. And then they developed a barrier that would be in front and a tape that would just shoot up in the air and let them go. But as you can imagine, a bunch of high-spirited horses with jockeys trying to get an edge, it was quite a melee. And the start was, there were probably more horses, more races won and lost at the start then than there are today. And that it just seems, from our standpoint, it just seems total chaos when you think about having horses lining up and with no barrier, no gate to make it an even start.
Hopping of horses. This was something that when I read it, I knew about this, but the laws and regulations today regarding horse racing are so much different than they were in the early 1900s. Explain what hopping of horses is. And
well, it's giving
able to work with it.
It's giving them something, some sort of chemical stimulant with the idea of making them run faster than they would otherwise. And it's a very inexact science, as you can imagine. The testing of horses, originally saliva testing before it moved into urine testing and blood testing, didn't start institutionally until about 1933. And over the years, there was the presumption that various people did, tried different things. There's a wonderful old French racing print from about 1760, and it shows a guy with a big, it looks like a funnel that you might, like a cocktail shaker almost, and as the horse is being led to the start, right out in the public, he is just stuffing something down this horse's throat. So it was clear that it was expected that, okay, we're going to give this horse something. So that's the extreme. But until about 1933, it was kind of an open game, and it was not until into the 20s that the racing authorities really began to realize that this was not something that you really that should be part of the game, and so the efforts began to be very when the science came along and you could test for things, that's when things changed. And it's still an ongoing thing that the temptation to try to get an edge in any sport, especially a sport that has a lot of gambling, there's a need for a constant vigilance about it. But I knew an old guy once who told me in the 30s his trick was to put a touch of arsenic on the horse's tongue as he left the paddock to go to the racetrack. But then if something happened that delayed the start, the horses, the few minutes of stimulation that you could gather from that would be lost. So it was cheating was an inexact science.
As I think it often is today.
Right, right.
There is a horse that I fell in love with, and that was Exterminator.
Ah.
And the story is just, again, it makes for fabulous reading, because this is an animal that when it was purchased, the guy that ended up getting it said the blankety-blank goat couldn't beat a fat man running uphill. I mean, he just looked at this horse and said, "You've got to be kidding."
Right. It
this
really
horse
was.
This is going to go nowhere.
It really was a wonderful story, and it spoke so well for Mr. McDaniel, who was the trainer, who recognized something in the horse. The owner had a very good horse named Sunbriar, and they needed somebody, another horse, just as a workmate, just a morning workout horse for Sunbriar. And the owner authorized, I think, $700, and the trainer wound up spotting a horse he paid 10 times that. And, you're right, that could be a movie, that the horse who was purchased as the workmate winds up winning the Kentucky Derby and then went on to be a great horse. I mean, in this country, your listeners may have heard of the great horse John Henry, who just passed away a couple of weeks ago, was a great old gelding who raced for many years. And Exterminator had a career very similar to John Henry's in that he raced for many years. Had been castrated as a young horse, so he couldn't go into breeding, and he just kept racing on to the age of 9 or so. And he really was a wonderful animal, and his nickname was Old Bones because he kind of had an angular bit of conformation, and his hips stuck out and so forth. But And his owner, Willis Sharp Kilmer, I don't mean to ramble, but he was, as it says in the book there, he made his money selling swamp root, which was supposed to be some sort of kidney-specific that would cure everything. I think of W.C. Fields in his bit of selling some sort of elixir that will cure everything. But Mr. Kilmer was a very flamboyant person and had a lot to do with the development and popularization of golf in this country. He was lived in upstate New York and was an early proponent of golf tournaments in that area.
With Exterminator, this animal was so intelligent that nobody could get him to do anything until he really was ready.
Right.
But
right.
His groom, Exterminator's groom, had such a bond with this animal. He got to know him so well. I mean, you talk about how he put on 3 pairs of socks to help Exterminator be able to walk on a track that had mud ankle deep.
Yeah.
That, you know, just the visual description of that was what is in the story is amazing, taking a horse out. And then the groom did something I've never heard of anybody doing. He emptied his pockets of pennies and put them into Exterminator's water bucket. And it was a ritual. It was a superstition that the groom had. And it was from generations of black grooms. And
right.
Their belief was that copper wire or pennies were like vitamins and minerals to a horse's bones. It couldn't hurt. And his horse was going to need everything that he possibly would have to have. But it's a story of bonding between a man and a horse that when it happens, it's so rare. I mean, I haven't heard many stories about this kind of a connection.
Well, there's a lot of factors there, and I think it's so fast. I was so struck by that with the copper, and to think today there are a lot of people who wear copper bracelets
mm-hmm.
because they think it's good for rheumatism or arthritis and so forth. But the one thing that's so charming about horse racing is that you can have a horse, and the people that you hear about, his owner, obviously the owner has made this investment, the trainer has this job to do, but the groom is the human being that is closest to the animal on a day-to-day basis. It would be like most grooms don't take care of more than 3 or 4 horses, so they have an intimate connection that on a personal basis that transcends what the owner or trainer usually does. It would be like just think of your dog. You're the one who he sits on your lap, and you're the one who can tell his moods, and you're the first one to realize if he's not feeling well. And a really good groom can be a wonderful part of the success of a racehorse because he understands what keeps the horse happy, what upsets the horse, and you're right, that's an arch example of that mystical kind of connection between a man and a horse that is totally, behind the scenes. If you go to the horse races, you see the guy, maybe the groom leads him to the paddock, and then the jockey's on him. He wins the race. The trainer meets him in the winner's circle. But the groom is a really fascinating part of the whole racing world.
They really are. And one of the things that really blew my mind was the visual that was given about Churchill Downs. Now, when we see Churchill Downs on television today, millions and millions of people watch a Kentucky Derby every year. I don't think many of them have a clue that Churchill Downs was used for growing potatoes at one time. I mean, that was hysterical to me, but it was more.
Right.
And they were growing potatoes at Churchill Downs, and they got 1,000 bushels of potatoes a month so that we could feed our troops.
Right. I mean, that's when you think of, okay, it's a mile in circumference, and you've got all that grass in the infield, and we're at war, so what makes more sense than to use that? And in later years, Churchill Downs was used for like a National Guard encampment during the next war. So it really is a stunning visual. It's hard to imagine when you see that frolicking throng in the infield and on Derby Day. If you had to have any potatoes in there today, they'd all get smashed by noon on Derby Day, I believe. To have mashed potatoes.
Well, Exterminator was a phenomenal horse, but there are so many other wonderful horses in this book. There's Elwood, there's Donnerail, there's Bold Venture, there's Dark Star, Canonero, Genuine Risk, Thunder Gulch, Giacomo. You have these wonderful, wonderful stories about this institution that's 133 years old, that every year people from all over the world come in, pay tremendous prices to get in. The average Joe will be in there just to watch it, and you're watching it on television. Was there ever a vision that it would reach so many people in such a manner at any time? Did anybody even have the concept that that could be possible?
I would think not. One of my regrets about my relationship with my father was he never had any interest in racing, but he always said, "I'd love to see the Kentucky Derby." And I never just sat down and said, "Well, why? What is it about? What appeals to you about it, you who don't follow horse racing, and yet you want to be, you're compelled by this event in the same way that people might feel about the Indianapolis 500 or a heavyweight boxing match?" But there's, I tell you, I've been involved since 1963, and I've often tried to put in words just what it's all about, and I can never reduce it to words. There's a whole bunch of facts you can trace and say this happened, this happened, this happened, but what really is the magic to it, I've never been able to put down and get my arms around it. But Colonel Wynn was a big part of it. He began just blithely announcing about 1945 that the crowd was 100,000. And then it turned out that it was many years later that the crowd actually got that large. And then once the race began to be, I think the race was first broadcast in the early 1920s on the radio, and then it was telecast nationally for the first time in 1952. So there was as television sort of changed the whole dynamic of how individuals related to news events, the Derby was one of those events that took on a more personal connection. You could see it instead of just know it was happening and read about it the next day.
Well, there's nothing like being at a racetrack and having the feel of the energy. I've never been a gambling person, but I know what it was like for me when I had the opportunity to be in the paddock and see the thoroughbreds and to be close to those magnificent animals and then to watch them run. There's something, there is the magic. The animals are the magic, the grooms, the riders, and it only lasts about a minute, if that. I mean,
right.
It's just incredible, but it is an energy that is phenomenal. My guest today has been Ed Bowen. We've been talking about the greatest Kentucky Derby upsets. We were only able to get into a couple. If you love thoroughbreds, if you love the races, if you love horses, you just should get this book. It is absolutely incredible. The stories will keep you mentally gripped right on the edge of your seat because they are exciting. They're interesting. It's about American history. It's about the history of the horse. And it's just wonderful. Ed, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure having you. This is Donna Sebo. We are going to be taking a break. Don't you go away now. I've got more good things to share with you. We'll be right back.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Ged Rose. Buy it today, 800-872-8852.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
This is Mickey from Aldo Rocks. You're listening to BBS Radio,
the number one internet radio network on the planet.
That's bbsradio.com.
Words can't truly describe what you see. Words can't truly describe what you hear. Yet some words can inspire you to see and hear images and sounds impossible to describe. Janubia, language of the heart. You've never heard anything like it, but like it you will. JANUBIA.com. Available on iTunes and Amazon.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Telephone lines are now open. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. Canadians, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Also, 530-876-3222. That's 530-876-3222. I know we've got a caller on the line, and we're going to show you how it's done on the Donna Sebo Show. If you're a new listener, oh, we're so delighted to have you join us here every day, Monday through Friday, from 3 to 4 Pacific time. And tell your friends. I also know if you've missed an interview, you're going to be able to listen to it at your convenience in our archive section. Donna Sebo here. Let's go to our first caller. First name or initial, and where are you calling from?
Is this me?
Excuse me, dear.
Okay, my name is Kathleen. I'm in San Francisco, California.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
One of my favorite cities. I just love San Francisco. Wow, it's got a life all of its own and so many good places to go eat.
That's true.
It's a walking city. Oh, my goodness. You can just go everywhere in San Francisco. Okay, Kathleen, let's get down to business with you. I would like you to, if you can, be patient with feeling like you're not in sync. It happens to all of us at one time or another, but there is this almost like a feeling of sluggishness. I feel like I'm not really, I haven't got the oomph that I'm supposed to have. And I look at you and I want to say, don't worry about it. Be sort of methodical and just say, I can only do one thing at a time, and give yourself about a week. Maybe it could be as long as 2 weeks, because I think there are a couple things going on here. Number one, I think you're tired. Number two, I think you have been pushing, and it's as if something inside of you is saying, if you don't shift down out of fourth gear into first, you're heading for a problem. So I want you to pay attention and don't feel like you've got to be pedaling 5,000 miles an hour. That's not a requirement. That is not a requirement. So take it easy with yourself, because you are beginning to come into what I describe as a rhythm. And I'm just feeling this rhythm, and little by little it's coming into a flow, so that when you want to make some changes, and it could have something to do with the upcoming holiday season and all kinds of variables that you've been having to deal with finally being taken care of, and you're sort of in this in-between phase. Relax. Enjoy it. Don't get overly stressed. You're going to be able to take care of all of it easily and readily. It's all going to fall into place very, very nicely. So take it easy. Don't beat yourself up if you think, oh, my goodness, if I only had another 12 hours in the day, I'd get everything done. Trust me, you could have another 12 and you wouldn't get any more done. So just be patient with yourself and know that little by little, you're getting back into that rhythm that you need to be back into. What's on your mind, dear? What did you want to ask me about today?
Okay, well, actually, my question was about a man I met, and I'm wondering if his feelings are reciprocated. Of course, I don't know him too well. But
all right, hon, your voice is a little bit low.
Oh, okay.
So could you speak up? You've met this gentleman, and what were you wondering?
I just wonder if he's as attracted to me as I am to him.
I think somewhat, but I don't know that it's exceptional. I believe that there is a chemistry between the two of you. I think you just need to relax and just let it flow. Don't try to force it. Don't get anxious about it. And figure, gee, if he's really interested, he's going to let me know.
Okay.
I would just be at ease with it. And I think the reason I want to encourage you to just not make a big deal out of it is because I'm seeing you in this out-of-rhythm moment, and I don't want you to try to force anything.
Mm-hmm.
You're a doer. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No.
But you are someone, if you say you're going to do it, you do it.
Mm-hmm.
So you often try to exert a lot of control, and you're in a period here where trying to control is not going to serve you all that well. So just let go, relax. If he happens to ask you out, fabulous, which I think he will, but I wouldn't worry about it. If it works, great. If it doesn't, that's okay, too. Go shopping.
Okay. Thank you,
okay.
Donna.
All right, dear. You have a wonderful day.
Okay, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Donna Sebo, and if you'd like to give me a buzz, you can do that. Telephone lines are open. See, it's so simple. All I need is your first name or your initial, and then after that, let me do my thing. 877-876-5227. Canadian, 888-815-9756. Also, 530-876-3222. By the way, for those of you that have sent me emails, I am so apologetic because I haven't been able to get to all of them. I am so backlogged with having been on the road for almost 2 months that it's taking me a while to catch up. But just know I will respond to you eventually, and if you haven't heard from me within the next 2 weeks, send me another email saying, Donna, hello, don't forget me, I want to know about this, that, or the other, or I have a story. I do have to say one thing. I've had some requests for people for me to do some spontaneous readings via email for the radio show. I do not do that. We do it live, and you call into the station, and I will talk to you. But I do not do readings via email. I do them by appointment if you wanted to do that with me privately, or you can call me, and it doesn't cost you a penny on the show itself. Again, 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756. Let's go to our next caller. Welcome to the show. First name or initial, and where are you calling from?
Hi, Donna. This is Nancy, and I'm calling from Lacey, Washington.
Where in Washington?
Lacey. It's right by the Olympia Capitol.
Oh, yes. Oh, my goodness, yes. And is it as cold down your way?
No, not really.
Really?
Boy, it was
down in the
street
where we are. My gracious. I was expecting frost on the windows. But it's not gotten there yet. Not yet, but oh boy, it's getting close. It is getting close. Okay, Nancy, first thing that I want to let you know about is your patience is paying off. You are getting your financial picture in order, and you're doing a good job at the planning side with money. And you're also going to be able to make the lifestyle change that you really, really want. I'm getting the number 2. I think it's going to be in about 2 years. I could be wrong. It might be 2 months, but I don't think so. I think it's in about 2 years, and I believe that you are really going to be pleased. Now, you have got 1, 2, 3, 4 people in your environment that are, you know, either friends or working associates, and they're really going to have a rough time this upcoming holiday season. So I want to say to you, because a couple of these individuals have members of family or associates that are ill, and it's quite serious, I just say, remember, a telephone call means a lot. And if you wanted to send a card or have some kind of a thoughtful gift, you know, whatever it is that you wanted to do, just to say, don't feel you're alone, you're not. There are people that care. You know, that kind of a thoughtfulness. It will mean a lot to these individuals. I don't know why, Nancy, but it can be puppies, it can be kitties, it can be people. But if anybody's hurting, they always seem to be attracted to you.
Yeah.
I think you could be a Florence Nightingale. You could put a shingle out. And they'd say, yes, that's the woman we're supposed to see. I don't know what it is. You're very, very compassionate, and you're very, very caring. But what I like most is that intuitively you know when to distance yourself. You have a way of being able to detach. And that is such a wonderful, wonderful gift, because it empowers you, and yet it allows you to be the gracious, caring person that you are. And should you decide you want to do hospice work, go for it, because you will just, it will be just very, very important to you. But I'm not seeing you doing it all the time. I think there's going to be a period where you're going to want to be involved with it, and I think it's great. I really do. I think you've got a knack with people, and if you're not a counselor, you should look at becoming involved as a counselor or as a therapist on some level, because you have a great talent in that capacity. And I'd love to see you develop it. Hmm. What question do you have for me, Nancy?
Well, do you see me ever getting into healing work?
Oh, my goodness. I think I just answered that. My goodness, dear. You have, it all depends on what you want to do. It all depends on the medium of healing.
Uh-huh.
And I think that you do it very effectively in a counseling format.
Counseling.
And if there is a particular style or therapy that you would like to become certified in, go for it. Go for it. I think you're going to find there's many, many ways that you can heal. You're not in a box.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as you understand that and you just do what you love to do, I think it's a given. I don't even think there's a need to ask the question.
Wow.
And that's my bias.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's because I'm coming from my perspective of overview. I think it's just part of the journey. I think that's why you're where you are right now.
Okay.
Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does.
Good.
The only struggle I'm having right now is I'm trying to heal myself so that I can help heal others, because I was doing it reversed.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kept getting sicker and sicker. It wasn't because I was doing healing, because I got into the healing work to heal me.
Mm-hmm.
But do you see me getting better then?
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Yes.
I think that is, again, that's part of the reason why you're doing this. You're discovering yourself. And the process of discovery takes many, many different venues. You're just experiencing one.
That sounds wonderful.
Well, I wish you the best, my dear. You're a natural.
Thank you. You made my day.
Oh, terrific.
Bless you.
Thank you, dear.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. This is Donna. We're going to take a break for just a moment. When we come back, I've got some wonderful things I'm going to share with you. So don't go away, and we'll just keep on. And you can call in, too, if you want. So don't go away.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay only $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 1-800-872-8852. That's 1-800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Gedrose. Buy it today. 1-800-872-8852.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 877-876-5227. If you're in the U.S., that's 877-876-5227. Canadians, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. We also have a direct line of 530-876-3222. I want to quickly tell you about my guests this week. Winter's Eve and Christmas Eve. Yes, we're getting into the holiday season. Lisa Johnson is going to be my guest, and we're going to be talking about these two children's books. And it's just wonderful to get into the feel like this. It's absolutely terrific because often we don't know what to get our kids, or we wonder about things that might be a little bit different. So these are going to be great. And then we're going to be talking with Katie Bannister on Thursday about the personal care attendant guide. And just the other day, I was talking with someone that was facing some physical challenges, and they were saying how they couldn't figure out what to do, how to go about doing research on finding someone that would qualify to be a caretaker. So Katie is going to be answering some of those questions. And then Betty Young, we're going to be talking about how you teach kids to care. Next week, we have got some very, very special things. We're going to be talking about the kiss of a dolphin. We're going to be talking about Ripley's Believe It or Not, seniors, how they can organize, and remembrances of time past, and also talking turkey. Yes, and gobble, gobble, gobble. Oh, good, yes. Oh, it's just so much fun. I love this time of the year, don't you? There's just so much going on. There's so much color. There is so much that's happening. And sometimes we can just feel absolutely overwhelmed to the point that we can't enjoy ourselves. I think sometimes if you're anything like me, and I just have to be honest with you because I do this, sometimes we overbook ourselves. Do you ever find that you get to a point where you're doing such a wonderful job of being so busy, you feel like you're a hamster on a wheel, and you go, how do I get off of this stupid thing? How do I get out of the hamster cage? Well, usually it takes making it okay to just say turning off the phone, turning off everything, and just maybe going for a walk. Or maybe you just absolutely close down for a week or maybe a whole day. It's a funny thing when you do that. The world doesn't seem to really care. We often get so involved with ourselves and what we think is the status quo that we forget the world is going to continue to spin whether we're out there doing a tango or not. And if we want to be sure that we enjoy wellness, and if we want to give time to ourselves for meditation or just to be able to be quiet a little bit, you have to do it. One of the things I find And this has been my experience through the years, and I share it with you because, hey, it's what I've experienced, and so I know I can be an expert in my own world. I can't speak for yours. But I find that the older I get, the more I have to be consciously aware of where I put my thinking and my attitudes. It is so easy. It is so easy to get stuck in mental muck. My goodness, you can get stuck. And you can start talking about how this is bad and that is bad and oh, this is terrible and oh my goodness, there's this and this and this. And you go on and you go on and you go on. And before you know it, you are in that hamster's wheel and you don't have a bloomin' hope of getting off of it unless you stop running around circles mentally and maybe even physically, pulling yourself in. You have to realize that you're the one, you're the only one that's totally in charge of how you think. You are the one that can stop the hamster's wheel of monotonous repetition of going nowhere in your thinking and then focus, refocus where you really want to be. And a good thing to do maybe is have an affirmation or maybe you have a vision board or something that's in front of you that you look at and say, that's where I want to be. That's really what I see for myself. That's really what I want to demonstrate. Well, you, however you do it. But I know I have to say to myself, gee, this is what I need to do. Also, I think we need to remember, no matter what age we are, whether we're a teenager, whether we're 90 years old, dreaming big is important. We always have to look at the bigger picture so that we can realize that there is so much to life. And lots of times I think what helps us to be able to dream bigger and better is to put ourselves in different environments. Maybe you volunteer to work for a vet, or maybe you go and help a friend, or you decide you're going to take a class, or you're going to do something that's different. You step out of your box, or better yet, your hamster's cage. You get off the treadmill of doing the same thing over and over and over again. Maybe watch television programming, or go see a movie that's about something you've never explored before. Be willing to open your mind. Your dreams then can expand in ways you never thought possible. And you know what? You need to be nice to yourself, too. How many times do you say, oh, God, I am so stupid. Why didn't I do this better? Oh, gee, well, can anybody be as dumb as me? Do you ever say things like that to yourself? I have. So it took a bit of discipline to say, wait a minute, if I'm saying that to me, that's not doing me any favors because I'm not dumb and I'm not stupid. So we just look at and we make a shift, don't we? We shift out. And it's remember we have to remember, too, those words shouldn't leave our mouths about other people as well. I have an awareness of an individual when they get really uptight to call everybody stupid. And I just looked at him and I said, well, stupid is as stupid does. And it's more fun when you flip stuff back at people. Because often we get into habits and we don't realize what we're doing. We don't realize that we're affirming what we really don't want. Instead of looking at what we do want, we're letting stuff come out of our minds. It has to come from our mind and our mouths, but it's coming out of our mouths as well as our minds, and consequently, we end up getting into trouble. So the negative, it's a part of life. I'm not that naive not to recognize that we have challenges. We do. But realize your mind and your mouth, you want to pay attention to what you do with them. The old adage, garbage in, garbage out, is very true. So if you find garbage coming out of your thinking and then proceeding to flow out of your mouth, then stop it. Reverse it. Make it into something worthwhile. Make your words count. And think, because it really makes a difference. I know we're just about out of time. I want to say thank you again to those of you who are sending me these wonderful stories. Oh, and if you've got some special holiday recipes, won't you share them? I had someone send me a site on cookie recipes. My gracious, this one site has a gazillion of them. I don't know how anybody had the time to put them all in. But I've got a wonderful recipe that I pulled off of there that I'm going to be sharing with you one day this week. It's chocolate chili cookies, perfect for the holidays. If you're a chocolate person like I am, you will enjoy it just as much as I do. And I know I'm talking about goodies. And there's the old saying, a minute on the lips and it's 5 years on the hips. Well, we're just going to know that whatever we put out over on the Donna Sebo Show, it doesn't work that way. It's just absolutely magically without any calories. This is Donna Sebo. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. You are the person that is the sculptor of your life, of your experiences. What is it you want to have? Dream big. After all, it's your dream, isn't it? This is Donna Sebo. We'll be talking with you tomorrow, same time, same place. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.
Wanna feel it in my soul.